This episode of The Yarn is sponsored by Heinemann in their professional book, Breathing New Life into Book Clubs, Practical Guide for Teachers. Colby talked with co-author Sonia Cherry Paul about the book.
In book clubs, our kids were really reading. They were excited and energized to read. And what we tried to do was to give educators lots of practical tips and strategies. You know, once you sort of think through those big pieces of the puzzles, you'll get swept up in the excitement and the fun that the kids are experiencing, and it won't feel as intimidating as we might imagine. Hopefully, this is a book that inspires teachers to light a fire for reading in the classroom.
So, whether you're looking to freshen up your classroom book clubs or begin implementing them for the first time, Breathing New Life into Book Clubs is a great place to start. Visit Heinemann.com to learn more and order a copy.
I'm in holed up in the mountains in New Mexico, hiding from COVID, and I have a pet rattlesnake under my porch. Oh. And he buzzes. Well, not now, it's cold, but when the weather warms up, he'll buzz once in a while when I step out.
That voice you just heard is three-time Newbery Honor-winning author and my favorite author as a kid, Gary Paulson.
And then now and then a deer or an elk, not elk so much, now and then a bear wanders through the yard, kind of. They don't bother me or anything, but there's no noise. But I'm only 25 miles from a bombing range, in the Mexico bombing range. Every once in a while I hear the planes go over on training runs. Sounds like thunder, kind of, but not very often.
Welcome to The Yarn, a school library journal production. I'm Colby Sharp. Not gonna lie, don't think I've ever been as excited to share something with you as I am today. I fell in love with reading in fourth grade when my teacher read us Hatchet. And having the opportunity to talk to Gary for the Yarn podcast was the most excited I have ever been to talk to someone on the phone. It was everything that I hoped it would be and a whole lot more. I hope you enjoy this episode with The Yarn as much as I enjoyed talking to the legend, Gary Paulson.
Gary, I just want to start by saying thank you. I would not be a teacher today if it wasn't for Mrs. Collins in fourth grade reading us Hatchet. I was changed forever by the experience of that read aloud. And I only have two possessions from my childhood. I just don't like to hold on to things. And one is a baseball card. And the other I'm holding in my hand now, which is the hatchet that I bought from a little tiny amusement park in our state during the read aloud. And I just am forever grateful for you and for your words and for what they have meant to so many readers and teachers and librarians. And thank you for taking the time to chat with me today about your new book, Gone to the Woods. I am trying to figure out if I interview you as a podcast host or a nerdy 10-year-old who's pretending to be Brian in the woods behind our school. So,
first off, thank you for the comments. And I honor what you do. Teaching is, God, it's so necessary and so wonderful now, especially. I won't go into political details, but we really need more. And thank you for doing that.
That means a lot. I really appreciate it. It's been an interesting year teaching in the classroom, and then sometimes we're teaching in our living rooms and just trying to take it day by day.
It's a bizarre time, really. I mean, really strange.
And
finding new strength in people is one of the byproducts of what's going on, I think. It's really parts of it are wonderful in an awful way, you know.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a doctor in Scranton, young guy, and he's just completing his residency. And he's just in a firefight all the time in this hospital. He's doing trauma and emergency stuff. And he caught COVID. He caught COVID doing it.
And
kind of waded through it while I was working. Jeez. Mm. I mean, it's just incredible. Imagine. It really is incredible.
Yeah, we are blessed to have people out there doing that kind of work. I applaud
As for the other thing, I'm still the nerd. I'm still a 10-year-old nerd. I didn't apparently change. Somewhere along the way, I forgot to alter that one. And
there's nothing wrong with that. Well, I guess that's a nice segue into Gone to the Woods, Surviving a Lost Childhood. Can you just start by telling us a little bit about this book?
Sure. It was originally in my mind going to be several books. They're autobiographical, and I'd written about a lot of those things before, but not the specific things. I'd written about my parts of my life before in other books. For instance, in Hatchet, we talked about that, but I've been in forced landings and bush planes. I've been in a lot of time in the woods, decades in the woods. But there were pivotal points in my life, almost spiritual points where everything altered. One of them when I was young and spent time with my aunt and uncle, Sig and Edie, on their farm. Another time in the Philippines, as essentially a street kid in Manila. And then in the Army, where I was 3 years, 8 months, 21 days, and 9 hours. I hated the Army, and somehow they promoted me to sergeant, which is insane. I couldn't. When I went in, we got $78 a month, and they took 10% for charity. So they had to give $7.80 a month back to United Fund. and finally, all the time of my youth, when things were bad, and it was bad. I mean, my folks were drunks and just parts of it were ragged. But the woods became a sanctuary for me. I flunked school. The teachers tried, but my home life was so horrific that there's nothing I can do to compensate for it. And the woods just became a place I could go and be safe. And then later, the libraries. But at first, the woods. So when I wrote about it, I decided to do it slightly from a view so that I could be more abstract about it instead of being first person all the time. And it surprised me as I wrote to see my life. Well, to see my life, just that phrase, to stand back and see it without feeling it, without being in it, you know, was really surprising for me and kind of liberating. So that it made it easier to write some of the harder parts and made the beautiful parts more beautiful. It really did. I miss the book. I know how that sounds. But I really miss it now, and I'm done. I'm doing other books for it with Wes. With FS&G, with Macmillan. However we're stacking that. But as soon as I finished the book, I thought I should write it down. What the hell? I should write this down, and I did. But parts of the book are vibrant to me. Are still alive. Still alive.
Wow.
Except geese. I will hate geese till I die. Okay. So we got to.
So I have this image in my head of what it looks like. When Gary Paulson is writing a book, can you tell me a little bit about your process, but also where are you when you wrote this book? Like, I don't know if you were in the middle of the woods, if you were on a sailboat in the middle of the ocean. Like, tell me a little bit about
your process. On lots of the book, I was on a boat, or I sailed to Fiji and back. I sailed up to Alaska, which the third book with FSNG was that. I sailed to the Sea of Cortez, but I also was in the woods a lot running dogs. I had 25,000 miles on dog sleds training for the race that I did around, and then just running dogs. God, they're wonderful, you know, just beautiful. And it is a dance, the dogs. And I rode all the time. I rode Hatchet in camps training for the race. And I had set up a tent at 20, 30 below. I had a candle in the fruit jar. And I'd light the candle, I'd write longhand. And then I know it sounds hokey, but I did. And then I would put it on a computer later. The location was less important than the story. I'm a writer who does those things. I'm not a dog musher who writes, or a sailor who writes, or a soldier who writes. I'm a writer. I really finally realized that somewhere along the way. Wherever I am, I work and I read. I read constantly. If I can't read physically in my hands, I have audio in the truck. My truck, I have to drive a lot of my truck back and forth. I'm up in a shack in the mountains, but my wife is about 70 miles from here in Tularosa, New Mexico, with her studio and stuff. I go down to help her out. So I'm commuting almost daily, 70 miles each way, which is a good time to listen to books. I love to write the way you fall in love. When a story works, the hair goes up in my neck, like a wolf smelling blood or something. Maybe that's a little too graphic, but it's like that. It's very intense. There'll come a time when it clicks, when it just about clicks, and when that happens, it's just, God, it's wonderful. It is so incredible, the feeling that I get. It's like love. It really is love. I think it initially started stories back with somebody dancing around a fire with bloody skins on their back telling what the hunt was like. And ultimately it became language, which, thank God, I'm a miserable dancer. But it morphs into that. When I write and it works, like it worked with this book, there are moments in the book where it works intensely like that, and it's almost like going back and dancing around the fire and saying what that was like. It's almost in that level of kind of gut level stuff. It's really incredible. I know it sounds, I don't mean it to be bragging or arrogant or anything. It's just intensely wonderful. Still is. And I've done this for a long time.
What do you like to read?
I read several books many times. I read Patrick O'Brien, his Sea books. He was such a master with language. My God, it just, and William Manchester, who was a historian who wrote biographies, wrote an incredible book called A World Lit Only by Fire, which is about the beginning of the Renaissance. Melville, and then for a long time I just read everything. I read, like I tell kids to read, I read like a wolf eats. I read Westerns and mysteries, and I wrote them, too. I mean, I wrote Westerns sometimes for $300 each just to stay alive and write, you know. Mysteries, too, a lot of mysteries. Magazine writing, whatever. I did seven different articles once on Baron von Richthofen, the First World War fighter pilot. And each article went to a different men's magazine, and each article proved a different point. He was a pathological killer or a hunter or a hero or a coward or whatever. I proved all those, and he was all those things. He was. I just worked hard all the time. And I got on a tangent there, sorry.
No, I am fascinated by the reading life of writers.
If I couldn't read, I think, I've said this to other people many times, but we're the only species who has saved our knowledge and forwards our knowledge extragenetically. No other species, and there are other species that are smart, especially dogs or dolphins or whatever. I mean, there are many things smarter than us, I think, but they don't have the way to spend that knowledge forward in a way. And the way we've chosen to do is in print. It's not on films, really. That doesn't work the same. And the end result of that is that all we know, I went to the archives once, a couple of times, in Washington doing research, and it's just staggering. It's all there. It's free. You can go and read the actual things. You know, the that's how I learned about Sally Hemings, who was owned by Thomas Jefferson and used by her. I won't go into details, but you know what I mean. And I was going through paperwork in the archives of the stuff that he had done, written. I mean, it's all there. And for us to deny that and kill libraries or kill teaching or kill just so we can have football, Jesus. I won't go there either, but it's such a waste. It's such a waste of effort and money and stuff. It's just incredibly stupid. It really is.
Yeah, and in your new book, you share how you became a storyteller and how you became a writer. Can you talk a little bit about that?
A librarian. I was flunking in school. And it's kind of funny because I was about 13, eighth grade, and I just started to fall apart. And I just stayed in the woods, actually. I trapped a lot and hunted and fished. But I skipped school and got in trouble. I was in trouble all the time, fighting all the time. And I went to the library once to get out of the cold weather. It was about 30 below. It was warm. And it just felt gentle. It was the only thing in my life gentle. My parents were raging drunks. I mean, my life was a raging mess. And this librarian just asked me what I wanted, and I said nothing. She said, "Would you like a book?" Hard to talk about it. I didn't read much. I was a poor reader. And she gave me a book to read. She gave me a library card, and my name was on a card. It just floored me. It was one of those paper little cards with a metal embosser on it that you use for the old days that you punched out. And she gave me that card and printed my name right. It was like it gave me an identity. And then she offered me a book, and I felt I had to take one. I took one. We lived in a tenement building. I couldn't be up when they were drunk, so I stayed in the basement of this old building with a old furnace and a stuffed chair, the spring sticking through it. And I staggered through that book. I can't remember what it was. I read, and I reread, and I reread. And I had to go back and tell her about it because she was so nice. And this went on for months, years, actually. I'd go in and get a book, and she'd say, "Well, try this one." She did, and she'd slip in a Melville or a Dickens, and then ask me about them. And then one day, like in the piece that I wrote, she had a Scripto notebook with blue and a brand new yellow pencil, and she said, "You should write down some of the things." I call them thought pictures, and she said, you should write some of them down. I said, for who? And she said, for me.
Oh,
floored me. I was 14, 15. Well, then I, senior year, I was flunking. I was going to not graduate. And the state stepped in and told me, honest to God, told me face up, that so that I wouldn't be a burden on society. Jeez. I should take vocational school and either become a TV repairman or an auto mechanic. Well, I was goofing around with electronics with a friend of mine who was a ham radio operator. And I learned a little about electronics from the inside. I thought, well, I'll become a TV repairman. And I wish to God I'd done cars, because I don't know anything about cars. And now I don't know how to fix TVs either, so I've never used that. But I've wobbled through that, and all that time I was still going to the library. And I ran off a lot, too. I ran away into North Dakota and worked on farms. Spent one summer working on a carnival, working on a tilt-a-whirl. That was an education. All of it is. All of it is. There's a kind of a primary innocence about it all. It's still that way for me. When I look back, there's the ugly parts that I lived and I did. My mother would set me up on a bar and sing songs to get drinks and men in a little soldier uniform in Chicago. And that was unpleasant. But there are moments that are sublime, too. And those are still that way for me. Watching Sig and Edie, bread coming out of the oven on a wood stove. She would do rolls, Edie would, and then rub them with butter. I'm salivating. God, things like that are still that way for me. They're still that way. In fact, I bake bread. I learned how to make just white bread, dumb old white bread. I just loads of bread. So and I do the same thing, rub them with butter when they're done. And
now all of the libraries have your books in them. What is that like?
I am often staggered by it. I don't know how to describe it except to say that it wasn't going to be me. It was never going to be me, Colby. It was never going to be me when I was a kid. I mean, it was horrible, some of the stuff. And some of it was beautiful, but it was never going to be me that became a thing. I was told even by my father, quote, I'm going to get Frenchy here, but you're not worth a shit. My own father told me that. There was just like a curse hanging around my neck. And when it worked, when I found that I could be story, do story, live story, become that thing, that wonderful dance, it was just astonishing to me. And then people would like it. My God, when I was doing Westerns for $300 each, there were no royalties there. There were no movie deals. There were no bestsellers and all that. It was just, I used pen names. One of my beauties was Paul Garrison, which I thought was a pretty clever way to change my name around. Anyway, when I found out that was happening, when I was told about the Newbery Honor on Dog Song, the first one, I was out in a kennel. I didn't know what it was, really. I knew it was good, but I didn't know what it did. I had some 38 dogs around me and a phone in my hand that my wife had brought out. And this woman said, we're calling to tell you won the Newbery Honor for your book, Dog Song. Are we an adult? This is. Can you edit this?
I can, yes.
I said, holy shit, that's a quote. And she said, she was in the hall, she was in the convention center on speakers, and that went out all through the speakers in booming English, holy bon. So I go back to the house, and it was a big deal. Okay, it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And we were living at about $3,000 a year. I'm serious. And trapping with four gardens. At four gardens, up in the North Woods. I had initially a 30-mile trap line on foot. I got involved with a publisher, Less Than Honest. Did some books for him. He got seized hold of them. They did well, and he never sent a check. I got some lawyers, and they got money, but I never got it. And I used the contracts to buy stuff. We'd been poor a long time. And I bought all this stuff and a house and cars and stereo, and all of it was repossessed. So I had $900 in my pocket, and we headed for the woods, northern Minnesota. Wife and kid and one dog. And when I got up there, started trapping on foot. I'm a good trapper and a good hunter. That doesn't mean, I don't think it's the right thing to do, but I had to do something. And we started gardens and got some goats, milk goats, made our own cheese. I got good at cheddar. I'm pretty good at cream cheese. My son lived on game, grouse and venison and porcupines and just different animals. And I just didn't, we didn't understand that we would have money. I really didn't. And then we get a check for $35,000 about 4 months later. And honest to God, called the publisher, said there's been a terrible mistake. I really did. I said, I should never have gotten this check. What are you doing? I said, it was a stunning amount of money. We could live 10 years on that. The 10 years, the way we were living, you know. They said, oh, no. In fact, a friend of mine, Ted Taylor, I called him, the writer Ted Taylor. He was a dear friend, and he says, "Oh no, you're good now." He says, "Hold on to the bar, kid." He called me kid. Hold on to the bar, kid. And of course, he was right. Next book I wrote was Hatchet, and off we went. But Hatchet was rejected 4 times.
Wow.
Thud. That got quiet. Thud. Yeah. At one point I was getting 400 letters a day, 10 letters, and the books had a profound effect on people. I got a call from a huge international magazine. I'm not going to say the name, but I think we can guess here. And he wanted me to tell him where Brian lived because he wanted to interview him for the book. Or the magazine. I said, well, it's fiction. Wow. I said, it's fiction. It was the secretary calling. She says, my boss thinks it's real. What the hell am I going to tell him? I said, no, I mean, some of that stuff happened to me, but it's a story. It's fiction. God, is that profound? David Gale was a really good friend of mine. He's recently passed away, but I was on a tour we were in Portland, Oregon, and I was giving a talk, and there were 300-400 people in the room. And this guy came in the back up a little. I had done a book interviewing soldiers coming back from Nam. One of the first things I did, actually, because people were just spitting on them, and it wasn't right. And so I just wanted to show what they had gone through. And I got death threats on the book and stuff. But anyway, I was sometimes not in a healthy place. So while I'm talking, I saw this guy come in the back of the room. David was back there. And he had on jeans and a white T-shirt, kind of just not dressed very well. And he stood looking around for a while. And I thought, oh, God, here it goes. And he leaned down. He found David somehow. And he handed him something off. He went. Then he left. So we were going to go, and we were at the hotel lobby sitting by a fountain, that David and I, waiting for a ride to the airport. And he said, oh, this guy handed me this envelope for you. And I opened it up, and I won't say his name because it's embarrassing, but it was a letter to me saying he'd been illiterate. And he had read Hatchet, and it caused him to read. And he wrote two letters. The first one to his son, telling him he could read. And the second one was to me. So I'm crying now, but I'm bawling. David says, what the hell happened? What happened? He thought somebody died. I hand him the letter, he's bawling. The two of us are clinging to each other, crying in the Portland hotel lobby. It looked like a problem in our relationship. Oh, God. Hatchet has somehow it's astonishing people. This doctor I mentioned that was the same age as Hatchet. His birthday, when Hatchet was 30 years old, he was 30. And it changed his life and made him want to become a doctor and to become a wilderness doctor. That's what he's trying to train for. Because the book caught him. And he was not doing well. He was having trouble in school and stuff. So, I mean, I didn't set out to do that. But it just caught a nerve. And some other things that I've written since have. I think this book has some of that. Mm-hmm. And again, it just, because it's real to me, it was real. Those rolls coming out of the oven, sitting on the back of workhorses while they pull a mower or a corn cultivator in the hot summer sun on your back.
I guess I don't want to keep you too long, Gary, but I want to end with one last question that I've been thinking about as you talk. And, you know, it sounds like things could have ended up a lot differently for you. obviously, but I just, as someone who, you know, I spend every day with 10 and 11 year olds, and, you know, a lot of them their lives are rough as yours was, and, you know, different circumstances and similar circumstances, I'm sure.
When I was touring a lot, I would always specify that I wanted to also go to schools or areas where, or prisons or, you know, confinement places, to talk to young people who would never have a chance, especially back in the hills in Kentucky and, you know, some of those places. I've said this to other places, but I think if I can make it, anybody can make it. And that's what I tell young people, that it can be as bad as you think it is. And it is bad. My God, it's awful for some people. But the bad part goes to bed at night. I was told that by a sergeant in the Army. It can be just the worst thing in your life, but it'll go to bed at night. Even the bad ones sleep. And you never know about the next day. It's just, you know. Plus, there are places now you can get help. You can get, you know. But I think if there's any hope for us, it's young people, of course. And I think we need to specifically reach out for that, to help those that need help.
Right. I think that your books continue to do that, and I'm so excited to be able to share this new one with the readers in my classroom, and I know I'm very jealous. Our fourth grade teachers read Hatchet aloud. So maybe this is one that I can share with my kids. I feel like that's not fair. I'm like, don't you understand what this book means to me? You need to stop reading it. But obviously I can't do that. So.
Oh, Colby, you're wonderful.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Yarn. Thank you to Heinemann for sponsoring this episode. Thank you to all of you for helping kids find their Hatchet, for helping kids find their Gary Paulson, for helping the readers of today and tomorrow find stories that they can fall in love with and that they will hold in their heart for the rest of their life. Thank you to my co-host, Travis Yonker, for helping me edit this episode. And thank you to Gary Paulson for your stories, your time, and all that you mean to teachers, to kids, and librarians. My name is Colby Sharp. Thank you for listening.